Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the Twenties, Third Edition, by Jeffrey Jensen Arnett. Narrated by Mike Chamberlain. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and tables present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Preface to the Third Edition. Emerging adulthood is now a well-established field, with thousands of researchers using the term and the theory, in fields from developmental psychology to education to medicine. The success of it and the spread of it is a gratifying affirmation that paradigms matter. Ideas matter. Psychology is more than just the accumulation of data. Of course, data are important, but we get a lot better data, and they make a lot more sense, if we seek them out, guided by a framework for what we are looking for and what it might mean. The theory of emerging adulthood has served that purpose well for many people. The first two editions of this book have been highly successful and have been translated into many languages, including Chinese, Greek, Korean, Spanish, Turkish, and Portuguese. I decided to write a third edition of Emerging Adulthood for a variety of reasons. It has become the foundational text of the field, and I know it is the book that scholars entering the field look for and rely on. It is used in colleges and universities by many instructors who have created courses on emerging adulthood over the past 20 years, and I wanted them to be able to use a book that has kept up with the knowledge in the field. It's a book written for a broad audience, and I wanted it to be fully up to date for the parents, teachers, and curious general listeners who find it. Plus, I thought writing a new edition would be fun, and it was. I greatly enjoyed digging broadly and deeply into the research that has been done since the second edition. I was often surprised by how much had changed, especially in areas such as media use, where emerging adults lead the way as the digital natives of their society, and their technology preferences are constantly shifting as new and better forms are created. I also enjoyed adding a new chapter on cultural variations in emerging adulthood. I am a developmental psychologist, but also a cultural psychologist, and the cultural variability of development has been fascinating to me since I first began my career. In 30 years of research on emerging adulthood, I have mentored and collaborated with and encouraged researchers all over the world. Adding the new chapter on cultural variations gave me the chance to celebrate some of the best contributions by talented young researchers in Brazil, China, India, and South Africa. The rest of the book focuses on my American research, and the cultural variations provide a welcome and enlightening contrast at the end. Although there is a common international pattern in longer and more widespread education and in steadily rising ages of entering marriage and parenthood, there are fascinating international variations in what typically occurs in emerging adulthood, how it is experienced, and what is valued most during these vital years. Chapter 14 provides a taste of these variations and points the way to emerging adulthood's international future as a field. The Cultural Future of Emerging Adulthood. In the 30 years since I first became interested in development during ages 18 to 29, the trends I pointed to then have continued to spread, not just in the United States, but all over the world. Education or training after high school has become even more common and even more necessary, as technology does more and more of the manufacturing work, and the knowledge economy becomes ever more complex and diverse. The median ages of entering marriage and parenthood continue to rise steadily across countries, and are past age 30 in nearly every developed country. Developing countries are following the same pattern as they join the global economy. In this book, I focus mostly on emerging adults in the United States, because they are the ones I know best, but I am very excited about emerging adulthood's cultural future. Although the world's societies are becoming more similar in their demographics and more connected in their economies, there remains an immense amount of cultural diversity and a wide range of cultural paths for emerging adults to follow. As Chapter 14 illustrates, the individualism that we Americans often assume is universal is actually unusual in the rest of the world, and emerging adults often feel a strong sense of obligation to their family of origin, even as they strive for their individual goals. Filial piety is still strong in China, even as millions of emerging adults leave the rural villages where they grew up and migrate to the big cities to pursue a better, more expansive future for themselves and for the families they left behind. Emerging adults in India are still mostly content to have their parents choose their marriage partner, continuing a cultural tradition thousands of years old. In Africa, emerging adults ironically acknowledge the black tax, that is, the expectation that as they take advantage of the abundant opportunities opening up in education and work, they will not only raise themselves in the world, but help their family members rise as well. In Brazil, too, cultural traditions of family obligation now compete with emerging adults striving for individual goals. Cultural beliefs and practices are changing in all these places, even as they remain deeply rooted in long-standing traditions. We are a culturally creative species, so no doubt we will continue to invent new combinations of values and new ways of being. Emerging adults, with their combination of freedom, openness, and optimism, will often lead the way. So, let 1,000 research flowers bloom. Let's continue investigating all of the many paths through the late teens and the 20s that occur, both within and between our societies. If you are a researcher, policymaker, or practitioner, consider joining the Society for the Study of Emerging Adulthood, SSEA, ssea.org, to connect with your colleagues worldwide and contribute to this booming field. Chapter 1. A Longer Road to Adulthood. Since the mid-20th century, a quiet revolution has taken place for young people in American society, so quiet that it has been noticed only gradually and incompletely. As recently as 1960, the typical 21-year-old was married or about to be married, caring for a newborn child or expecting one soon, done with education or about to be done, and settled into a long-term job or a role as a full-time mother. Young people of that time grew up quickly and made serious long-term choices about their lives at a relatively early age. Today, the life of a typical 21-year-old could hardly be more different. Marriage and parenthood are at least 8 years off. Education may last several more years through an extended undergraduate program, the 4-year degree in 5, 6, or more, and perhaps graduate or professional school. Job changes are frequent, as young people look for work that not only pays well, but also will be enjoyable and fulfilling. For the young Americans of the 21st century, the road to adulthood is a long one. They leave home at age 18 or 19, and from their late teens to their late 20s, they explore the possibilities available to them in love and work, gradually moving toward making enduring choices. Such freedom to explore different options is exciting, and this is a time of high hopes and big dreams. However, it is also a time of high anxiety, because the lives of young people are so unsettled, and many of them have no idea where their explorations will lead. They struggle with uncertainty, even as they revel in being freer than they ever were in childhood, or ever will be once they take on the full weight of adult responsibilities. To be a young American today is to experience both excitement and uneasiness, wide-open possibility and confusion, new freedoms and new fears. The rise in the ages of entering marriage and parenthood, the spread of education and training beyond secondary school, and prolonged job instability during the 20s reflect the rise of a new life stage for young people in the United States and other economically developed countries, lasting from the late teens through the late 20s. This period is not simply an extended adolescence. because it is very different from adolescence, much freer from parental control, much more a period of independent exploration. Nor is it really young adulthood, since this term implies that an early stage of adulthood has been reached, whereas most young people in their 20s have not made the transitions historically associated with adult status, especially stable work, marriage, and parenthood, and most of them feel they have not yet reached adulthood. It is a new and historically unprecedented stage of the life course, so it requires a new term and a new way of thinking. I have proposed that we call it emerging adulthood. For some time, Americans have noticed the change in how young people experience their late teens and their 20s. In the 1990s, Generation X became a widely used term for people in this age period, inspired by Douglas Copeland's 1991 novel of that title. Next, a generation of millennials was claimed to share certain characteristics by virtue of having come of age around the year 2000, as if transition to a new millennium possessed some kind of mystical power. Millennials were followed by Generation Z, distinguished by their obsession with social media. However, the characteristics of today's young people are not merely generational. The changes that have created emerging adulthood are here to stay. There is little reason to doubt that the young people of the future will experience an extended period of exploration and instability in their late teens and 20s. For this reason, I believe emerging adulthood should be recognized as a distinct new life stage that will be around for many generations to come. In this book, I describe the characteristics of emerging adults, based mainly on my research over the past 30 years, plus a synthesis of other research and theories on the age period. In this opening chapter, I provide some historical background on the rise of emerging adulthood and describe the period's distinctive features. I also explain why the term emerging adulthood is preferable to other possible terms. Because most of my research has taken place in the United States, most of this book focuses on American emerging adults. But emerging adulthood is an international phenomenon. In the final chapter of this book, I discuss cultural variations in emerging adulthood. The Rise of Emerging Adulthood: Four Revolutions. Emerging adulthood has been created in part by the steep rise in the typical ages of marriage and parenthood that has taken place since the middle of the 20th century. As you can see in Figure 1.1, in 1960, the median age of marriage in the United States was just 20.3 for women and 22.8 for men. Figures can be found in the print and e-book formats of this book. Even as recently as 1970, these ages had risen only slightly. However, since 1970, there has been a dramatic shift in the ages when Americans typically get married. By 2021, the median age of marriage was 29 for women and 30 for men, an 8-year rise for both sexes in the span of just 5 decades, and still rising. The age of entering parenthood followed a similar pattern, although far more first births take place outside marriage now, 41% as of 2021, than was true in 1960. Later ages of marriage and parenthood have created a space between the late teens and the late 20s for the new life stage of emerging adulthood. But these later ages were not causes of the new life stage by themselves. Rather, they were reflections of other vast changes taking place in modern societies. Four revolutionary changes took place in the 1960s and 1970s that laid the foundation for the world as we know it today, including the new life stage of emerging adulthood: the technology revolution, the sexual revolution, the women's movement, and the youth movement. By the technology revolution, I do not mean smartphones and social media apps, but the manufacturing technologies that transformed the American economy. Because of extraordinary advances in technology, machines became able to perform most of the manufacturing jobs that were once the main source of employment in developed countries. Manufacturing production in the United States is actually 6 times higher now than it was in 1950, but new technologies have made that possible with far fewer jobs. As a consequence of this revolution, the United States and other developed countries have shifted from a manufacturing economy to a knowledge economy that requires information and technology skills. In the early 20th century, work often entailed making things in factory-based manufacturing jobs. By the early 21st century, most work involved using information in knowledge-based work such as business, finance, insurance, education, and health. Figure 1.2 shows how knowledge work, which economists call the service sector, has replaced the manufacturing sector as the primary basis of economic activity in the United States since the mid-20th century. The new knowledge economy emphasizes information and technology, and therefore requires post-secondary education and training for most jobs, especially for the jobs with the highest pay and status. Consequently, an exceptionally high proportion of young Americans, nearly 70%, now continue their education beyond high school. This is a higher proportion than ever before, as Figure 1.3 shows. Most young people wait until they have finished school before they start thinking seriously about making adult commitments such as marriage and parenthood. And for many of them, this means postponing these commitments until at least their late 20s. A second change was the sexual revolution, which was sparked by a technological change, the invention of the birth control pill in 1964. The ease and availability of the pill led directly to the sexual revolution that began in the late 1960s, including less stringent standards of sexual morality. It became widely, if somewhat grudgingly, accepted that young people no longer had to enter marriage in order to have a regular sexual relationship. Today, most young people have a series of sexual relationships before entering marriage, and most Americans do not object to this, as long as sex does not begin at an age that is too early, whatever that is, and as long as the number of partners does not become too many, whatever that is. Although Americans may not be clear, in their own minds, about what the precise rules ought to be for young people's sexual behavior, there is widespread tolerance now for sexual relations between young people in their late teens and 20s in the context of a committed, loving relationship. The third major change of the 1960s and 1970s that shaped the lives of today's young people was the women's movement advocating greater rights and opportunities for women. As a consequence of the women's movement, young women's options have expanded in ways that make an early entry into adult obligations less desirable for them now compared to 60 years ago. The young women of 1960 were under a great deal of social pressure to catch a man. Remaining single was simply not a viable social status for a woman after her early 20s. Relatively few women attended college, and those who did were often there for the purpose of obtaining their MRS degree, in the joke of the day. That is, for the purpose of finding a husband. The range of occupations open to young women were severely restricted, as it had been traditionally. Secretary, waitress, teacher, nurse, perhaps a few others. Even these occupations were supposed to be temporary for young women. What they were really supposed to be focusing on was finding a husband and having children. Having no other real options, and facing social limbo if they remained unmarried for long, their yearning for marriage and children, the sooner the better, was sharpened. For the young women of the 21st century, all this has changed. At every level of education, from grade school through graduate school, girls now surpass boys. 60% of the undergraduates in America's colleges and universities are women, according to the most recent figures. Young women's occupational possibilities are now virtually unlimited, and although men still dominate in engineering and some sciences, women are equal to men in obtaining law, business, and medical degrees. With so many options open to them, and with so little pressure on them to marry by their early 20s, the lives of young American women today have changed almost beyond recognition from what they were in 1960. and most of them take on their new freedoms with alacrity, making the most of their emerging adult years before they enter marriage and parenthood. The fourth tectonic shift of the 1960s and 1970s was the youth movement, which denigrated adulthood and exalted being, acting, and feeling young. Never trust anyone over 30, and I hope I die before I get old were popular phrases during that era, spoken only half-humorously. As a consequence of the youth movement, there has been a profound change in how young people view the meaning and value of becoming an adult and entering the adult roles of spouse, parent, and employee. Young people of the 1950s were eager to enter adulthood and settle down. Perhaps because they grew up amid the upheavals of the Great Depression and World War II, attaining the stability of a secure job, marriage, home, and children seemed like a great achievement to them. Also, because many of them planned to have 3, 4, or even 5 or more children, they had good reason to get started early in order to have all the children they wanted and space them out at reasonable intervals. The young people of today, in contrast, see adulthood and its obligations in quite a different light. In their late teens and early 20s, marriage, home, and children are seen by most of them not as achievements to be pursued, but as perils to be avoided. It is not that they reject the prospect of marriage, home, and children, eventually. Most of them do want to take on all of these adult roles, and most of them will do so by the time they reach age 30 or just beyond. It is just that, in their late teens and early 20s, they ponder these obligations and think, yes, but not yet. Adulthood and its commitments offer security and stability, but also represent a closing of doors, the end of independence, the end of spontaneity, the end of a sense of wide-open possibility. Emerging adulthood lasts from roughly age 18, when most young people finish secondary school, to age 29, when most people have begun to move toward making the commitments that structure adult life, marriage or a long-term partnership, parenthood, and a long-term job. I have sometimes used 18 to 25 to refer to emerging adulthood, and sometimes 18 to 29, because the end of it is highly variable. Nothing magical happens at age 25 or 29 to end it. For most people, the late 20s are a time of moving toward a more settled adult life. But there are many, especially the highly educated urban young, who continue their emerging adult lifestyle through their late 20s and into their early 30s. Age 18 to 25 is a conservative range to use when age ranges are required for referring to emerging adulthood, because few 18 to 25-year-olds have passed the major milestones and entered a stable, established adulthood. However, 18 to 29 can be legitimately used as well to include the many people who do not make the transition into established adulthood until closer to age 30. The 18 to 29 age range also makes the most sense internationally, as median ages of entering marriage and parenthood are higher in all other developed countries than they are in the United States. Although the rise of emerging adulthood is reflected in rising ages of marriage and parenthood, marriage ages were also relatively high early in the 20th century and throughout the 19th century, especially for young men. What is different now is that young people are freer than they were in the past to use the intervening years between the end of secondary school and entry into marriage and parenthood to explore a wide range of different possible future paths. Young people of the past were constricted in a variety of ways, from gender roles to economics, that prevented them from using their late teens and 20s for exploration. In contrast, today's emerging adults have unprecedented freedom. Not all of them have an equal portion of it, to be certain. Some live in conditions of deprivation that make any chance of exploring life options severely limited at best. However, as a group, they have more freedom for exploration than young people in times past. Their society grants them a long moratorium in their late teens and 20s without expecting them to take on adult responsibilities as soon as they are able. Instead, They are allowed to move into adult responsibilities gradually, at their own pace. What is emerging adulthood? Emerging adulthood is defined primarily by its demographic outline. Longer and more widespread education, later entry into marriage and parenthood, and a prolonged and erratic transition to stable work have opened up a space for a new life stage in between adolescence and young adulthood, and emerging adulthood is what I have proposed to call that life stage. These demographic changes have taken place worldwide over the past half century, and so the rise of emerging adulthood is an international phenomenon, true of developed countries across the globe, and increasingly of developing countries as well. Wherever there is a substantial number of years between the time young people reach the end of adolescence, around age 18, and the time they enter stable adult roles in love and work, emerging adulthood can be said to be present. However, young people's experience of emerging adulthood is likely to vary considerably across national, cultural, and socioeconomic contexts. One stage, many paths, is how I like to put it. That is, it is best to think of it as one life stage with distinctive demographic characteristics, but with many possible paths through that stage in terms of how emerging adults experience their education, work, beliefs, self-development, and relationships. Some scholars have objected to calling emerging adulthood a new life stage. Life stages are universal, they say, and you admit that emerging adulthood is not universal, so it can't be a new life stage. But in my view, this is an erroneous view of life stages. A comprehensive look at how people in various cultures have conceived life stages across history shows that they are not universal after all, but socially and culturally invented to fit the realities and imaginations of a particular place and time. To give a simple but revealing example, in diverse cultures, the number of life stages varies from 3 or 4 to at least 13 in various life stage schemes. This is not because people's actual physical or cognitive or social development is divided neatly into 4 or 13 stages, depending on the culture, but because how we think about development can be divided into 3 or 13 life stages, or more, or fewer, or somewhere in between, depending on how we choose to conceptualize them. For emerging adulthood, I proposed it as a new life stage because I believe it can help us understand better what is occurring in development today, here and now, from the late teens through the 20s. My research has taken place mainly in the context of American society, first in the 300 interviews that were the basis of the first edition of this book, and since then in a variety of other studies. In the course of this research, I have sought to distinguish the features of American emerging adulthood that make it distinct from adolescence or young adulthood, and I will present these features in this section. I do not claim that these are universal features of 18 to 29-year-olds, regardless of their background. On the contrary, there is no doubt that other features will be found to be more important in other cultural and economic contexts around the world, and I will present some examples later in this book. The 5 features presented here represent my current conclusions as to the distinctive features of American emerging adults, based on my research over the past 30 years. They are proposed as distinctive to emerging adulthood, but not unique to it. That is, they may be experienced in other life stages as well, but according to my theory, they are more prevalent and prominent in emerging adulthood than in other stages. So, what are the distinguishing features of emerging adulthood in the United States? What makes it distinct from the adolescence that precedes it and the established adulthood that follows? There are 5 main features. 1. Identity explorations. Answering the question, who am I? And trying out various life options, especially in love and work. 2. Instability in love, work, and place of residence. 3. Self-focus, as obligations to others reach a lifespan low point. 4.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?